The Honorable Fred A. Hartley, Jr., co-author of the Taft-Hartley Act, defends his book, Our New National Labor Policy, on The Author Meets the Critics. Here to do battle for and against Mr. Hartley's book are critics Merrill S. Rukeyser and Robert F. Wagner, Jr. But first, meet the peacemaker on these programs, your regular chairman, John K. M. McCaffrey.
Good afternoon, everyone. Probably no single legislation in recent times has aroused so much controversy as the Taft-Hartley Act, which was passed by the Congress last year in the face of the veto of President Truman. It's been the crucial issue in the presidential campaign this year, and there are many experts, even some pollsters, who feel the vote last week was largely determined by public reaction to the Taft-Hartley Act. In a minute, you'll meet the man who originated with Senator Taft this controversial labor law. But first, here's a sample of how two eminent authorities feel about Mr. Hartley's book, and I think feeling is the correct word, and the legislation which bears his name. First, the planning commissioner of the city of New York, son of the author of the Wagner Act, and one of New York's most prominent liberal political leaders, Mr. Robert F. Wagner, Jr.
Mr. McCaffrey, ladies and gentlemen, I know before we indulge in our controversy here today that one thing we're certain of, that the sincerity back of Congressman Hartley's views cannot be questioned. However, his book entitled Our New National Labor Policy creates a sort of a dream world of labor relations, which is far removed from the turbulent realities of everyday life. The sweep of events since the dawn of the 20th century is given no recognition in the views and attitudes expressed in this book. Congressman Hartley indicates his opposition to the Social Security laws, the United States Employment Service, the Wage and Hour Administration. In view of the platforms of both the Democratic and Republican parties, it is clear that, with respect to these matters, Congressman Hartley speaks for a very small minority of the American people. Certainly, enlightened industrialists in the United States would not look with favor to a return to the sweatshop and the unconscionable opposition, and oppression, rather, of the working man. It is equally clear that the American people have rejected the views expressed by Congressman Hartley at the very first opportunity. And what Congressman Hartley calls the new national labor policy will soon become, once again, the old labor policy. Democratic life can survive only through sustained progress, and many of the principles embodied in the book under discussion must necessarily fall by the wayside.
Thank you, Mr. Wagner. And now meet another eminent authority with an entirely different point of view, the financial columnist for the Hearst newspapers, Mr. Merrill S. Rukeyser.
The election upset has added to the importance and timeliness of Representative Fred A. Hartley's new book, entitled Our New National Labor Policy. Such an authentic statement is all the more necessary because of the Hitlerian lies of monster proportions told about the act, which was shamefacedly and unwarrantably mislabeled as a slave labor law. The lying propaganda was so impudent that a survey reported in Look magazine indicated that while union members were in favor of the principal provisions of the law, they were opposed to the law itself. Since the unions which supported President Truman's re-election will demand their pound of flesh, the new 81st Congress will need to make a fresh audit of the legislation. It seems safe to forecast that the Congress will not do less than change the name of the law and will at least make some face-saving amendments. But such a moderate and discriminate procedure would constitute an anticlimax, since the sponsors of the act themselves, recognizing its experimental nature, set up a watchdog committee of the two houses of Congress to observe the law in operation and to suggest amendments and revisions. And in the book, Representative Hartley himself proposes 7 amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Rukeyser. Now, you've heard from the critics pro and con, and before the author meets his critics face to face, here with a brief summary of his own book is the author of Our New National Labor Policy, Congressman Fred A. Hartley, Jr.
Mr. McCaffrey and Mr. Wagner, Mr. Rukeyser, and ladies and gentlemen, my purpose in writing the book, Our New National Labor Policy, was to attempt to answer the many things that have been said about this law. I might say it's been called a great many things, and so have its authors. Mr. Green, the president of the American Federation of Labor, called it a slave labor law. And Mr. Phil Murray, the president of the CIO, called it a diabolical monstrosity. Well, I'll be very frank and tell you that the defense of this law has not been nearly as adequate as the criticism of the law. And what I have tried to do in writing this book was to tell exactly what we did, and in addition to that, to give students of government an inside story as to the procedures involved in the writing of a piece of legislation of this kind. I also want to make it perfectly clear that in this book I've tried to show that even its sponsors have not said that the Taft-Hartley law was perfect and should never be amended. We merely say that we did the best wrote the best possible law that could have been written under the circumstances. And I also contend in this book that in writing the Taft-Hartley law, we were in no way interfering with the legitimate functions of the labor movement. We were merely attempting to correct some of its abuses. But above either the selfish rights of labor or the selfish rights of management, we tried to take into consideration that which was in the public interest. And I'm satisfied that history will show that that is the kind of a job that we did in writing this law.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hartley. Now, I think, Mr. Wagner, that both Mr. Rukeyser and Mr. Hartley have given you food for thought and perhaps some ignition for some powder.
Well, of course, first of all, Mr. McCaffrey, one of the interesting things, actually with my name being Wagner, is what Congressman Hartley had to say about some of the provisions of the Wagner Act. He objects strenuously in his book to the statement in the Wagner Act, reading that the denial by employers of the right of employees to organize and the refusal of employers to accept the procedure of collective bargaining lead to strikes and other forms of industrial strife. Well, the simple facts are that there are a good deal of labor unrest before the Wagner Act became the law of the land. In fact, the history of labor strikes prior to the Wagner Act is one of turbulence, violence, and bloodshed. The Wagner Act was adopted only after a considerable period of experience under the original National Labor Board, which Senator Wagner was chairman. It is apparent that Congressman Hartley has forgotten the history of trade unionism in the United States. The major cause of strikes prior to the enactment of the Wagner Act was union recognition. It was only after unions were recognized as bargaining agents that a period of industrial stability developed, and unions and employers were able to bargain about conditions of employment such as hours, wages, and so on. During the campaign, we heard a great deal about the fact that since the Taft-Hartley Act has been in operation, there have been much less strikes than prior to that time. Of course, we have to take into consideration the fact that under the Wagner Act and some of the other New Deal legislation, we have more people now employed than ever before in our history. People are more contented, and there's less reason to have strikes as there were in the past.
I'm sorry, Mr. Wagner. I'm afraid I can't contain Mr. Rukeyser anymore. Mr. Rukeyser, do you
Mr. McCaffrey, I must be getting old. I used to do these radio chores with our distinguished speaker's father. And speaking of the Wagner Act, I was on another network a few months ago.
Don't mention it.
Senator George W. Malone of Nevada, who was one of the two Republican senators who voted against the Taft-Hartley Act, was on the program. I told told his brain trust before he went on the air that I was going to ask him to explain his vote, and he said, don't do that. But I did it anyway, and then when he gave the explanation, he ceased to be a hero with the unions, because up to that point, all the unions said he was the white-haired boy. But I asked him, why were you one of the two Republican senators to vote against the Taft-Hartley Act? This may be news to you, Mr. Hartley. And he said, well, I voted against it because it embodied in the new act many of the features of the Wagner Act, which I thought was fundamentally unsound. By that time, he'd lost all the labor support, and he'd already lost the employer support, so he was out on a limb. But he struck a note of truth.
I think you're moving a little bit out on one, Mr. Rukeyser, but go ahead.
He struck... are you talking seriously or humorously?
That's up to you, Mr. Rukeyser. Go ahead.
I never know whether a humorist means it. The important thing, as brought out in the book, is that the Taft-Hartley Act does embody many of the main features of the Wagner Act, which are designed to prevent the individual working man from coercion by the employer. What it adds is a whole set of provisions designed to protect him also from coercion by labor union bosses.
Mr. Wagner.
Well, I think one of the fundamental things about the book that struck me was the fact that Mr. Hartley, as I said in the beginning, I believe was absolutely honest in what he tried to do and sincere. But he gives in his book the reasons for his various provisions, of his amendments, too, of the act when it was before Congress. He explains his side of the picture, but as far as labor or the labor leaders' point of view is concerned, all he said that they were arrogant and they didn't like the bill and he didn't like their attitude and so on and so forth. I think it was unfair in the book not to set forth their arguments against the bill, because I feel that perhaps Mr. Hartley may feel some of them are arrogant, but there are distinguished labor leaders who are opposed to it. Men right here in the city, David Dubinsky, Jacob Potofsky, and other men of real stature who were sincerely opposed to it. I feel that their point of view should have been expressed so the readers could have both sides of the picture.
Mr. Rukeyser.
The other eminent Republican senator who voted against the Taft-Hartley Act was Wayne Morse of Oregon. And while the legislation was pending, as a sincere friend of the unions, Senator Morse warned them that they were utterly uncooperative with the congressional committees. And he said if they didn't give some sympathetic help to the efforts of the congressional committees to write new legislation, they'd be doing a disservice to the unions. And that came from the sincerest friend of organized labor on the Republican side of the Senate.
Well, we know now, if we didn't know before, who is for and who is against the Taft-Hartley bill. But tell me, Mr. Wagner, what are the specific provisions of the bill defended in this book, Our New National Labor Policy, to which you object?
Well, in the first place, throughout the bill, of course, are we discussing the Taft-Hartley Act or the New National Labor Policy?
The New National Labor Policy, which results from that act.
Well, the whole attitude expressed in the book is the fear of the growth of unionism. Mr. Hartley wants to keep unions small. He wants them to bargain on a basis of one small union bargaining with an employer. He has attempted to discourage in his legislation and in his future program the idea that bargaining can be done on a large scale by international unions. He feels that workers should have the right to work regardless of whether they join a union. He is opposed to the closed shop, which has been of great benefit to labor. He is in favor of a union shop only after an election. And we know full well that under the National Labor Board, we have had terrific complications. The board has been burdened with an election for every single union. And it is a beautiful tool in the hands of the employer who wants to see to it that he can stall off unionism in his plant as long as possible.
Well, I think the person to answer these charges is our author of the afternoon, Representative Mr. Fred A. Hartley, Jr.
Thank you, Mr. McCaffrey. And I want to, of course, attribute the same sincerity to Mr. Wagner and to his distinguished father, Senator Wagner, that he has attributed to me. But there are some things that he has stated in connection with the book and in connection with the law which I would like to correct, because I find myself in complete disagreement with the statements he's made. Now, for example, I do not object to the preamble to of the Wagner Act reciting that the refusal of employers to bargain is a cause of strikes. But all we have done in the Taft-Hartley law was to add that not only are employers responsible for strikes, that there are labor leaders that will refuse to bargain and who are responsible for strikes. And I'll point one out right at the very moment. Out on the West Coast, Harry Bridges has tied up the entire West Coast shipping there in a strike that is in no way involved in a labor situation. It's a political strike against the Marshall Plan. And it's that type of strike that we're trying to deal with in the Taft-Hartley law. Now, with regard to the Taft-Hartley law, and my statements in connection with the attitude of the leaders of labor who appeared before my committee, I was not only disappointed by their arrogance. They insulted the members of my committee, but in addition to that, and this is the more important thing, they refused to give this committee the benefit of any advice whatsoever. They said, let the House of Labor alone, let everything remain in the status quo. And that is what I criticize in the bill, not merely their arrogance. That was bad enough. Now, with regard to the union shop election, to show you that we approach this proposition from a most reasonable viewpoint, I'd point out to Mr. Wagner that that is one of the things in the law which we have recognized has been unfair and unworkable. That is the requirement of the election for a union shop, and the joint committee created under the law, of which I happen to be vice chairman, is making the recommendation to the 81st Congress that the requirement of that election be eliminated. In addition to that, I'd also point out that Mr. Wagner was in error when he said that I do not want to see, that I want to see unions confined to a bargaining at the local level or at the plant level. As a matter of fact, in my book, I point out that in spite of the difficulties in nationwide bargaining, actually no one has come up with what I consider to be an adequate solution to that problem. What I think he's confused with is the criticism that I have made of such strikes as have been led by John L. Lewis. And may I point this out? If the Taft-Hartley law is repealed, and if there is nothing in its place, even if they merely restore the Wagner Act with nothing additional, the President of the United States will be unable to deal with John L. Lewis should he call another nationwide strike in the coal industry, which would cripple not only the coal mines of this nation, but railroads, steel, and everything else depending on coal. And what I have advocated in the book, and by the way, this is not in the Taft-Hartley law, is merely that we apply the antitrust laws to a labor monopoly and restraint of trade just as we apply it to a business monopoly and restraint of trade, particularly when that restraint of trade affects the national public health and safety. And that's all we've done.
Mr. Wagner, you've been accused of distortion.
Well, I think it's merely a question of approach. The whole atmosphere, as I say, of the book is that many of the things that have been done under the New Deal, including their labor legislation, are wrong. Mr. Hartley, as I said, is sincere in his opposition. He is, I think, even in his book, if this is true, Mr. Hartley, you can correct me, he was the only one recorded in the House in opposition to the Wagner Act when it was originally passed. Is that true?
That is true, and I've said so in my book, and may I point out why? I felt that certain provisions of the Wagner Act were inequitable. For example, in your dad's bill, in your dad's original law, coercion applies only to an employer. It can't apply. There was no definition of coercion applying to a labor leader. And in order to qualify, to offer the motion to recommit the bill with instructions to apply the definition of coercion to a labor leader as well as an employer, I had to qualify in that manner. But may I say that as far as some of the other legislation, you mentioned, I think you inferred that I was opposed to the wage hour legislation and Social Security. I am not opposed to them. I voted for both of them, but I have disagreed vigorously in their administration. And may I add, too, that my criticism of the Wagner Act is not so much in the manner of the way the law was written, but as it was administered.
Mr. Rukaji?
I'm here not to represent either the Republican or the Democratic side of the Congress. There's too much politeness and too much Alphonse and Gaston sincerity. I think that the great error and the great curse of the Wagner Act was that after it was passed as an experimental piece of legislation, they held it was sacrosanct and above amendment, and the superior point of the Taft-Hartley Act was that they didn't make that same attempt to freeze it, even if they had won the election, but they'd set up a joint committee to watch it and to revise it, and it was designed to correct the error of the Wagner Act of setting up a double standard of morality, treating the unions as inviolable and treating the management as bad. There's nothing good or bad about corporations. Some corporations are good and some are bad. Same is true of unions. And the attempt in the Wagner Act to make it appear that the unions can do no wrong was sheer nonsense and sheer effrontery.
Well, aren't there laws which will take care of the bad union, Mr. Wagner?
Surely there are plenty of state laws that can take care of racketeering. And as a matter of fact, the nominee in the Republican Party this year, Governor Dewey, made a reputation going after those people right here in New York. Let me say this. I think we should bear in mind the fact that in labor relations, it's very easy to say we should have a law that will give benefits to both sides and rights to both sides, but in our day-to-day relationships here in an industrial nation, we must remember that the employee has always been at a disadvantage. He is one little individual, and he's got to band together in the union to at least get a break from the larger corporations or even the smaller corporations. And for that reason, although on the face of things, the Wagner Act originally may have seemed one-sided, it was to equalize the opportunity for the working man to stand on an equal footing with his employer, bargaining for wages and hours and working conditions.
I wonder if I could ask Mr. Rukeyser and you, Mr. Hartley, what is your objection to the closed shop, for instance?
My objection to the closed shop is that I don't believe any man, before he can get that job, should be required to be a member of the union.
Well, then will you answer me this question, Mr. Hartley? How is it possible for a union to maintain its contract with an employer if they do not have a closed shop, if they do not have control of the very people for whom they are contracting?
Very easily. Operate under the Taft-Hartley law, which provides that the employer does the hiring, and where there's a union shop, then the employee hired becomes a member of the union after he's been employed 30 days and subject to all its rules and regulations.
Well, now, how has it worked out? I can think of a recent case that came up before the National Labor Relations Board where, because of provisions of the Taft-Hartley Act, particularly in regard to mass picketing, the mass picketing was not allowed. Strikebreakers were brought into the plant, and after they had been in the plant 3 months, a union election was held in which the other union officers were thrown out, and we had, in effect, a company union. This seems to me a very effective way to break strikes, to import strikebreakers, and to destroy unionism.
I think you're talking about the Times Square case, and let me say this. All we in the Congress could do was to write the law. If it's administered in a way which we did not intend, that's another thing. And may I say...
But which can be administered so badly as that, Representative Hartley, seems to me to leave some room for improvement
Definitely. Definitely. And let me make my position perfectly clear on that point. I do not approve of, for example... permitting strikebreakers to come in and take the jobs away from strikers and then give them the right to vote, whereas the strikers are given no right to vote in the election.
And that has happened, has it not?
In only one case, the Times Square case. But let me say this, when we get back to this question of mass picketing and the use of force and violence in the conduct of a strike, I have no desire to interfere with the fundamental right that every worker has to strike. But I think there's an equally fundamental right that's been overlooked far too long in this nation, and that is the right of a worker who's got a job to go to that job free from any harm or threat of harm to himself and the members of his family. And I think the question of the respect for law and order in this nation in the conduct of an industrial dispute has been overlooked far too long. And I think that's one of the most important improvements, may I say, that should be made in the Taft-Hartley law, and that is to stop mass picketing from preventing workers from going to their jobs who want to work. By what stretch of the imagination has labor, over other segments of our society, the right by physical force and violence to keep a person from going to his job?
Have you forgotten, Representative Hartley, the violence which some of our recent strikes within New Deal days represented, where the forces of law and order contributed the violence, contributed the deaths and beating up of strikers?
I know of one or two instances where that took place. Only one or two. But let me say this. The cases of violence have been far greater on the side where organized goon squads in the city of New York, in the stock exchange strike, in the strike of the gasoline service stations in Detroit, where squads went from one service station to another perpetrating assaults on workers who went back to work. I don't believe in violence, whether it's on the side of labor or on the side of management. And I recognize that in times past, there was a great deal of violence perpetrated by management. But what I'm speaking for is law and order in the conduct of a strike.
I think we're getting off on tangents. We've got a few minutes left, and there's going to be a new Congress under new party control and a president with the responsibility of running the country in these 4 years of transition from an inflationary boom back to more normal conditions. I say to the 81st Congress, in revising the law and keeping what's good in it, do not take away from the president the tools which will enable him to carry on during this period. We saw an example in Paris yesterday of what happens when you are a little bit too polite to ask the heads of unions to take a communist oath or an anti-communist oath. They had a general strike in Paris yesterday for purely political purposes. This new Congress won't dare, in keeping its campaign pledges, to fail to provide the president with tools which will be necessary for him to carry on for 4 years.
Mr. Wagner. Yeah.
Are you worried about the preservation that now exists in the Taft-Hartley Act of the communist oaths? The non-communist oaths?
I'm not worried about it. I think it's exceedingly desirable. The shipping interests on the West Coast, which I just left, refuse to bargain with Bridges because they think that he's not interested in wages and hours and working conditions, but they think he has political objectives.
Well, we're getting a little away from the book, but as I understand from the press, the Secretary of Labor, Tobin, has already indicated that that's one of the phases he thought should be retained.
I didn't know that the Secretary of Labor wrote the legislation. I thought that the majority of both houses
that's
of Congress,
right,
including
is,
the Southern Democrats and the Northern Republicans, will write the legislation.
He has been asked by the President to set forth his views, which
I didn't know that the President wrote must legislation anymore.
Well, certainly, Mr. Rukeyser, you're not so naive as to think that the President doesn't have influence on legislation.
He had very little influence with the 79th Congress and with the 80th. And when a humorist says I'm naive, I don't know what he means.
I think
you've demonstrated it so well that even as a humorist, I don't need to labor the point any further. But
I don't think the moderator should engage in controversy with the participants.
That's what your concept of the moderator on this show is, Mr. Rukeyser, and we've had differences of opinion about that before. I decide that. Mr. Hartley.
Well, Mr. McCaffrey,
When I'm here, I talk too, Mr. McCaffrey.
Well, Mr. McCaffrey, I'd just like to say this. I recognize that the President has probably scored the greatest personal victory that any man has ever scored in a political campaign, but I'd also ask you to keep in mind this, that while that was a great personal victory, it was by no stretch of the imagination an avalanche or a landslide. It was the closest election, presidential election, since 1914, some 34 years ago. And I would remind you that 235 members of Congress who voted not once to make the Taft-Hartley bill the law of the land, but three times, have been reelected to Congress. So that I'm hoping that there will be a cooperative effort made to make whatever changes prove to be in order, but not to eliminate this law entirely, because if we do, in my judgment, and I'm going to make a little prediction here, that in my judgment we're going to witness the greatest era of industrial chaos that we have experienced in many and many a decade. And may I add that since the Taft-Hartley law has been in effect, to show its effect, the unions have greater membership than they ever had before, they have the best contracts they ever had before, and in addition to that, there have been fewer strikes since the Taft-Hartley law has been in effect than there were, and I say this with all due respect, during the first 4 years of the Wagner Act.
Mr. Wagner.
Well, of course, Congressman Hartley expressed then, as he did express in his book, that we would have chaos if we went back to the old days of the Wagner Act. Well, the history will have a difficult time to prove that we've had chaos under the Wagner Act. The unions made the greatest strides. We were developed into a great industrial nation, and during the war, with labor and industry cooperating and acting under the Wagner Act, we were able to make this country the arsenal of democracy. So I don't think we've got a great fear as to what will be done if we go back to the Wagner Act. We're not going to have economic collapse and social collapse here in this country.
Well, now, Mr. Hartley, certainly prediction has come into disrepute in recent weeks. But would you, in terms of your book, Our New National Labor Policy, care to make a prediction about how much of this is going to be retained, incorporated into our new policy, and how much you think will be changed either through the exigencies of political life or through a feeling on the part of the country?
First of all, I'd like you to keep in mind that I made that suggestion on the premise that the 81st Congress would do what Mr. Truman has said without qualification, and that is repeal the Taft-Hartley law. He's made no statement that there would be any new legislation to follow it. Now, in my judgment...
Yes, that's what I'd like to know. Will there be something to fill this?
I believe there will. I'm satisfied, or I think there's a strong possibility that they will repeal the Taft-Hartley law to get to dispose of the names Taft and Hartley, and that's all right with me. Then they may reenact the Wagner Act and take some of the provisions of the Taft-Hartley law, which have proved to be good even to those who are calling it all sorts of names. For example, the provision dealing with strikes which affect the national public health and safety, the non-communist affidavit, and some other provisions like the jurisdictional strike.
I'm sorry, gentlemen. Time's up for everybody, and here is Bob Sherry to tell what lies ahead on The Author Meets the Critics.
Next week, The Author Meets the Critics is pleased to announce its guest author will be Representative Sol Bloom, who is to be chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee in the 81st Congress. His book, The Autobiography of Sol Bloom, is a characteristically American story of a man who went to work at the age of 6 running errands in a factory and ultimately became the confidant of 3 presidents and an outstanding political figure of our time. Be sure to be with us next Sunday to hear Representative Saul Bloom meet his critics face to face. And now back to John McCaffrey.
Before closing, I'd like to thank you, Fred A. Hartley, Jr., for coming here today to discuss our new national labor policy, and to thank you, Robert F. Wagner, Jr., and Merle S. Rukeyser, for joining us. This is John McCaffrey saying good afternoon for The Author Meets the Critics.
The Author Meets the Critics is produced by Martin Stone, directed by Lee Jones, and came to you today from the RCA Exhibition Hall in Radio City. This is Bob Cherry speaking. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.